Everyone on the deck of the barge knew the place Hauk referred to. The Barony of Snakefish, like the eight others, had been consolidated by the program of unification into a network of city-states, walled fortresses that were almost sovereign nations. They were named after the barons who ruled them, and each conformed to standardized specs and layouts. 50-foot-high walls with Vulcan Phalanx gun towers mounted on each intersecting corner. There was a single legal way into and out of the Vills. The path was deadly to anyone who didn't have business walking it. Inside the walls, the Vill elite lived in the residential enclaves, four multi-leveled towers joined by pedestrian walkways. A certain amount of pre-dark technology was available to the elite, the so-called high towers. Vill society was strictly class and caste-based, so the higher a citizen's standing, the higher the residence in one of the towers. At the bottom level was the servant class, those who lived in abject squalor in the pits, which were consciously designed as ghettos. The residential towers were connected by major promenades to the administrative monolith, a massive cylinder of white stone jutting 300 feet into the air, the tallest building in the Vills. Every level of the administrative monolith fulfilled a specific Vill function. The base level, Epsilon, was the manufacturing facility. At the bottom of E level, there was a sealed-off section where convicted felons were held pending execution. Although Vill laws were complex, convoluted, and often deliberately arbitrary, violators were never sentenced to a term of imprisonment in the cell blocks. Locking away a criminal either for rehabilitation or punishment was not part of the program. Perpetrators of small crimes, those involved in petty thefts or low-level black marketeering in the Tartarus pits, were sentenced to permanent exile in the Outlands. People convicted of high crimes against the Vill itself were served termination warrants and executed. If they were suspected of participating in activities that fit the Baron's exceptionally loose definition of sedition, they were detained indefinitely, questioned incessantly, tortured viciously. Rumors were whispered about prisoners in the E-level section being flayed alive, their entrails unwrapped, their bones carefully broken into many, many pieces. The practices reserved for women were particularly vile. Grant, Bridget, and Kane knew the rumors had a very strong foundation in fact.
I know I'll probably regret asking this, but how do you figure just the two of you will be able to get us to those cells? The Vill is about 180 miles away, right?
Loxley spoke for the first time, his voice as melodious as a wood rasp being dragged over wet gravel.
We can just fucking shoot the three of you in your heads. How about that?
That'll make it a little hard to interrogate us, won't it?
Grant, getting you there won't be a problem.
Neither Grant, Bridget, nor Kane were inclined to question him further, particularly when they saw the small, cold smile crease Hauk's lips.
Signal them, Loxley.
Ready for pickup. We have the packages.
Within a handful of seconds, two tiny flecks of jet black outlined against the vast tapestry of azure appeared in the sky. The three Outlanders instantly identified the waspish configuration of deathbirds swooping from the shoreline on a direct course with the barge. Kane wasn't surprised by the sight of the deathbirds cutting across the sky like a pair of hungry vultures. By now, it was almost standard operating procedure for Mags, whatever or wherever the Vill, to call in air support when they thought Kane and his friends were cornered. It was becoming a predictable pattern, but opting for aerial travel wasn't surprising. The black choppers were the only form of air transportation to make a comeback after the nuke cost, and they were the sole property of the Vill's magistrate divisions. Painted a matte, non-reflective black, the chopper's sleek, streamlined contours were interrupted only by the two ventral stub wings. Each wing carried a pod of missiles. The multiple barrels of the chin-mounted chain gun in its swivel turret winked dully in the sunlight. Even though he was familiar with them, Kane couldn't deny that the Deathbird attack helicopters were frighteningly efficient pieces of machinery. They were modified AH-64 Apache attack gunships, and most of the ones in the Magistrate Division fleets had been re-engineered and retrofitted dozens of times. 30 feet long, 15 feet high, the maximum speed of the insect-like choppers was 185 miles per hour. In the hands of an experienced pilot, they could maneuver like hummingbirds, up, down, sideways, backward, all very swiftly and fairly quietly. They could fly day or night in just about any weather, and the twin-tail rotor blades crossed one another at 55 degrees to reduce engine noise. The turboshaft engines possessed exhaust suppression ports to further silence the craft. Their exterior armor could withstand hits from high-explosive rounds up to 25 millimeters. Nevertheless, Kane, Bridget Baptiste, and Grant knew from experience that regardless of how formidable the machines were, they were still mechanisms operated by human beings. They were vulnerable to a few carefully calculated offensive maneuvers.
Step out farther so the pilots can see you.
None of the three moved. Kane sensed Breeze Castiglione, Belvedere, and Tashlin becoming more tense and nervous with every inch the Deathbirds progressed.
You didn't answer the lady's question, Hauk.
The magistrate's lips curled back from his discolored teeth in a silent snarl, and he lunged forward, driving the barrel of his sin-eater hard into Kane's midsection. The air left Kane's lungs, and he doubled over, but by sheer force of will, he kept himself from falling to his knees. He knew if he did, he'd receive a mag-issue boot with its steel-reinforced toe in the mouth.
There's your answer, Baptiste. Breeze and his crew are dead.
He turned his head, trying to focus on Breeze through the blur of his pain-hazed vision.
You didn't buy your life when you sold us out, Breeze. You just bought yourself a little time. And now that time is up. It's been pointless knowing you.
The shadows of Deathbirds crawled across the deck of the barge, intersected, converged, and separated again. The spinning vanes created a downwash, sucking up the warm air, and created a stifling semi-vacuum full of swirling bits of trash and loose pieces of wood. Grant looked toward Castiglione.
You must have had a general idea that Hauk could fold something like this. Once we're aboard the birds, this whole place will be flash-blasted, and you with it.
Hauk waved up at the choppers, and they began to drop gracefully toward the stern of the barge, about 30 feet away. The gunships came to rest on their landing skids with barely a bump. Hauk pushed Kane toward the Deathbirds.
Go.
Kane forced himself to straighten, a flare of pain igniting in his torso.
Breeze, you better make up your mind about who you want to throw in with. You don't have a whole lot of time to think it over.
Hauk grabbed Kane by the longish hair at the back of his neck and at the same time kicked him behind the right knee. His leg buckled, and he would have fallen on his face if not for Hauk's agonizingly tight grip on his hair.
Shut the fuck up! He's not going to do anything but stand there like he's been told.
Tashlin's eyes suddenly went wide with fear.
Kane's right, Breeze. They'll kill us. They can't afford to let us live now.
Bitch!
The magistrate's 9mm parabellum round smacked into and through Tashlin's lower belly, just above the top edge of her G-string. The woman didn't cry out, but her body was jolted backward, tottering on the stilt heels of her boots. The shock of the bullet's impact traveled down her arms and sent her club twirling from her fingers. The weighted end of it struck Loxley's sin-eater, knocking it to one side, his finger reflexively constricting on the firing stud. The bullets pounded into Hauk's armored back. His polycarbonate deflected the bullets and kept them from penetrating, but it couldn't absorb all the kinetic energy. Almost all the wind was driven from his lungs. As a horrified Loxley frantically shifted his pistol away from his superior officer, Grant hit the man's exposed chin with his left fist and kicked the man's ankle with his right foot. Dazed and off balance, the magistrate careened backward, arms windmilling as he tried to keep his balance. He toppled rear-end first into the opening from which Breeze and Belvedere had drawn the metal cylinder. As Loxley's body disappeared, Hauk managed to drag a lungful of air into his laboring chest. He blinked repeatedly against the pain haze clouding his eyes, then gaped at the hollow mouth of the Derringer gripped in Breeze Castiglione's fist. The bore was no more than 5 inches from his face.
And what do you plan to do with that little toy, Slager? You think I'm going to surrender?
No, I think you're going to die, you woman-killing bastard!
Hauk's eyes widened in startled comprehension when he realized the pit boss was not bluffing. Castiglione slammed the bore of the simmering Derringer under Hauk's exposed chin and squeezed the trigger. The 38 caliber steel-jacketed round punched a path through tissue and jaw, driving up through the roof of the mouth and deep into Hauk's brain. Hauk crumpled without a sound of surprise, pain, or protest. Kane, Grant, and Bridget saw the raw, crimson-edged, ragged wound where his chin had been. A sooty halo ringed the lower portion of his face. He stared upward at the bright sky without blinking. Bridget Baptiste, although surprised by the suddenness of the mag's murder, wasted no time gaping at the body. Nor did she attend to Tashlin, who writhed on the deck, doubled up around her belly wound. Turning on a heel, she snatched her copperhead from where Castiglione had dropped it. She wasn't callous or even really dispassionate about the injured woman, but she had learned to prioritize over the past couple of years, particularly when her life or those of her friends might be at stake. Kane scooped up his sin-eater and kicked the leather-encased Barrett toward Grant. He felt terribly exposed, but the pair of Deathbirds weren't in position to hit much of anything with their onboard weapons, not even the chin-mounted miniguns. That situation could change within a couple of seconds once the pilots recovered from the shock of Hauk's murder. A body shifted behind the smoke-tinted foreport of the nearest bird, and the hatch popped open. Bridget clamped her subgun to her shoulder and squeezed the trigger, spraying the chopper with short bursts of 4.85mm rounds. The chopper hatch closed again. Kane struggled to strap his Sin-Eater's power holster to his forearm, at the same time watching Breeze Castiglione drop his derringer and kneel beside Tashlin, cradling her head in his hands. Belvedere, blinking around in a daze, took up position behind him as if his huge body would serve as a bulletproof bulwark. Tashlin, her lips working as she mouthed silent pleas, stared up at Breeze with pain-glazed eyes. Her hands cupped her lower belly, blood bubbling out between her fingers. Kane secured a buckle of the holster, a swift glance showing him that Tashlin had only disconnected the spring cable from the electric motor. She had lacked the knowledge to do more extensive damage to the weapon. It was the work of only a few seconds to reconnect the cable, and he did so with feverish haste. While he worked, Baptiste kept the magistrates penned up inside the Deathbirds with short bursts from her copperhead. At the same time, Grant unzipped the carrying case for the Barrett. Kane reconnected the cable and the holster mechanism, and the tiny electric motor whined as he tensed his wrist tendons. Sensitive actuators activated flexible cables in the holster and snapped the Sin-Eater smoothly into his waiting hand. Kane felt about 5 times better almost immediately.
We've got to find cover before the birds take off.
The chopper engines hit high revs. First one Deathbird, then the other, lifted off from the deck of the barge, the vanes beating at the air furiously. Both inscribed high and fast trajectories across the sky. Kane fired one round apiece, but he knew his snap-from-the-hip shots missed both helicopter gunships entirely. The boatman made a shambling, clumsy run for the area on the barge where he had moored his dinghy. He hadn't crossed more than 15 feet of deck when one of the Deathbirds rotated in the air, its chain gun opening up with a rattling roar. Little spear points of flame flickered from the spinning multiple barrels. A hailstorm of 50-caliber lead pounded into the man, breaking his body open, tearing away chunks of clothing, flesh, and bone. Flying ribbons of blood mixed with fragments of exploding deck. As his maimed body fell, the chopper's spinning rotors carried it swiftly out of weapons range.
Shit! We're their meat now.
Kane stepped over to Castiglione and Tashlin, casting a shadow over the woman's face. Tashlin gazed up at him, started to speak, then began to vomit all over herself. She tried to turn her body to ease the spasms, but she was unable to move. Castiglione held her head until the sickness passed. She gasped fitfully, and Kane knew the woman wasn't going anywhere ever again. Her spinal cord had been severed by the bullet.
I asked you a question, Castiglione.
Breeze looked up at Kane, tears brimming in his eyes.
Next barge over! Get to that! You'll find all the merchandise I have left under the tops.
Show us.
I won't leave Tasha.
Looking at Tashlin's face, Kane could only assume her complexion was ashen underneath the coating of cosmetics, but he had no difficulty reading death in her eyes.
If you don't come with us, you'll die with her.
I'm a dead man anyway, Kane. I can't ever go back to Snakefish, and I sure as shit don't want to try my luck scavenging in the Outlands.
Kane looked up and saw the two Deathbirds hovering, rocking on air currents like a pair of angry wasps as they set a plan of attack.
At least you'd be alive.
I'm not interested in just surviving. Even leeches can do that. Quality of life is more important to me than quantity.
Grant slid closer to Kane, rifle still at his shoulder as he tracked the gunships through the scope.
If that's the case, then your quantity is about to get pretty damn low.
Bridget picked up Grant's Sin-Eater and joined them, anxiously eyeing the black choppers as they kept well out of firearm range. She was all too aware of the absence of anything to put between her and her friends and the FLIR lenses of the birds.
We need to start moving.
See the vessel tethered to the barge? That's your best, your only hope. For whatever it's worth, I hope you make it.
Kane glanced dubiously toward the makeshift bridge stretching over the water, then back at the Deathbirds. They circled in a wide figure-eight pattern, the standard prelude to a strafing run.
Breeze, they won't ignore you to follow us, you know.
Believe it or not, I'm not sending you ahead as stalking horses to lead them away from me and my people.
For some reason, I believe you.
You and Bridget get going. I'll cover you.
Kane hesitated, then wheeled toward the heavy anchor chain between the two barges. The links of the chain were as thick as Grant's wrists and scabbed with rust. He hoped it would provide a degree of traction. Bridget followed at his heels, holding both her copperhead and Grant's power holster.
You want me to go first?
Bridget looked at the chain, gauging the slack, and then over her shoulder at the Deathbirds.
After you.
Kane didn't argue. Running on the balls of his feet, he crossed the chain bridge. It sagged only a little under his weight, and he made it to the next barge without a misstep. Bridget followed him swiftly, the sun striking flame-colored highlights from her mane of hair as it streamed out behind her. She joined him on the deck of the barge.
Grant, come on, goddammit!
Before Grant could answer, much less comply, the helicopter gunship swooped down out of the sun, rotors thundering, machine guns hammering. One of the Deathbirds took a 50-foot lead on the other. The slugs, spit by its minigun, scooped foaming spray out of the water in geysers. They struck the deck plates, glancing off with constellations of sparks. The rattle of impact was like a steady drum roll against tin. Grant chambered around from the Barrett's box magazine into the breech. His left hand cradled the 33-inch barrel, while his right curled around the pistol grip backing the trigger guard. He placed his eye against the scope and centered the crosshairs of the Barrett on the Deathbird's tinted forepart above the flickering rotating chain gun. He preferred a clean shot at the fuselage since the massive wrecking power of the 50-caliber round would obliterate the delicate inner workings of the machine. But under the circumstances, the cockpit and the pilot therein would have to suffice. The second Deathbird swooped lower, pinpoints of fire rippling in a rotating sequence from the chain gun and the chin turret. The staccato report sounded like stuttering thunderclaps. Fountains of water burst up all around the barge. Taking a deep breath and holding it, Grant called on his training, achieving a form of auto-hypnosis known as the mag mind, a technique that emptied the consciousness of non-essential thoughts. It allowed his instincts to take over. The sounds around him faded to nothing, and he closed his awareness even to the presence of the steady jackhammering of the minigun. The image of the plexiglass port behind the scope's crosshairs leaped into clear, sharp focus. Grant carefully squeezed into the trigger pull. Grant moved his shoulder expertly, taking the recoil, not otherwise shifting position. Through the scope, Grant saw a white stellated star appear on the plexiglass and the pilot's body jerk. The gunship performed an abrupt, almost frantic figure eight from west to east, banked sharply to starboard, veered wildly up, then sharply down. The Deathbird's companion was forced to execute a clumsy, evasive maneuver to avoid a mid-air collision. Grant couldn't be sure if the steel-jacketed bullet had penetrated the pilot when it pierced the cockpit, but the black chopper performed a clumsy pirouette, listing from side to side. Vanes and rotors beating the air, it lost altitude and hung motionless for a moment. Then it nosedived into the ocean at a 45-degree angle, barely 10 yards away from the stern of the barge, the smashing impact sending up a cascading wave of foam-edged water. Two of the vanes snapped from the turboshaft with a sound like gongs being struck. The blades pinwheeled manically in opposite directions. While the sea still roiled and splashed over the side of the barge, Grant spun and ran across the bridge, spanning the water between the two vessels.
Looks like you bagged another bird. Another notch for you.
Don't buy me a drink yet. One bird can still blow the shit out of the place, and us with it.
He may not want to risk it. His orders were to bring us in alive, not lose his machine. He could just decide to cut his losses.
I guess it depends on how angry we made him, or scared.
Hopefully he's thinking about all the awful stories he's heard about us. Maybe that'll be enough to drive him off. Or he could be calling for ground support.
Looking over at the other barge, Kane saw Belvedere lift Tashlin into his arms as if she weighed no more than a child. He followed Breeze Castiglione to where the dinghy was moored.
He wasn't sending us out as stalking horses, but he's not above taking advantage of the window of opportunity we opened for him.
Under the circumstances, wouldn't you?
Kane considered the question rhetorical, so he didn't answer it. Instead, he gave the deck of the barge a quick visual inspection, noting the various shapes humped up beneath tied-down canvas coverings. He strode quickly toward the nearest one. Grant and Bridget followed him. Grant walked backward, rifle at the ready, his eyes still on the distant Deathbird. It was so high the chopper looked like a black speck, a water beetle floating on the surface of a calm pool. The canvas covering was attached to bolts screwed into the deck, lashed down by rope drawn through eyelets at the corners.
Let's see what kind of merchandise Breeze was selling.
Pulling her folding K-bar knife from the snap-button sheath on her belt, Bridget slashed through two of the ropes. Kane pulled the canvas away and saw what he expected to see, an array of drab, military-green plastic crates stacked on the deck. Most of them were stenciled with the insignia of the Magistrate Division. With his foot, Kane pushed on a long, narrow case that appeared to be the standard dimensions to contain a pair of Law rocket launchers. He was a little surprised when it didn't budge, since most of the launchers he had handled were fairly lightweight. Taking the knife from Bridget, he inserted the point into the seal and pried. The lid popped open with surprising and suspicious ease. Kane stared down at the contents of the case, not really understanding what he was looking at for a long moment. The container held a collection of stones, all of them about the same size, ocean-smoothed rocks, obviously taken from the beach. Kane picked one up, then another, and gaped at them in angry disbelief.
That lying son of a bitch!
Imagine that, a pit boss who doesn't tell the truth. That's a new one.
Dropping the rocks, Kane glared toward the other barge. Castiglione, Belvedere, and Tashlin were nowhere in sight. Faintly, he heard the cough of an outboard motor coming to life.
Castiglione wouldn't hand everything he got from Chaffee over to Zakat. We saw what he brought to Thule. It didn't amount to a quarter of what would have been in the Snakefish armory.
Breeze has the rest of it stashed someplace else, obviously. He never had any intention of selling it to us, remember?
She sounded infuriatingly calm about the double cross, even slightly amused. Kane was not inclined to seek out the humor in the situation.
We wasted nearly 2 weeks setting this up. The couriers we used to contact Castiglione could be in custody right now.
They don't know the location of Cerberus. We use two levels of intermediary.
Let's argue about it once we're out of here. I think the bird finally made up its mind.
The three of them looked to the sky. The death bird swooped down over the graveyard of derelicts, its blades chopping through the air. Its landing skids were barely 20 feet above the surface of the sea, the vanes whipping wide ripples in the water. The gunship zeroed in on the dinghy holding Breeze Castiglione and his two people. Bullets from the helicopter's chain gun sent up miniature waterspouts all around the boat. Then a missile scorched from the aircraft's portside pod. The air thundered and shook and lit up with a brief flare of red light. The explosion gushed upward, shooting bits of metal and wood in all directions.
I think Breeze has been paid back for tricking us. Hope that makes you feel better.
Grant, Kane, and Bridget watched as the Deathbird curved back around for another pass. This time, the pilot skimmed even lower, the rotors beating up spuming waves across the ocean surface as it swept in to attack. Grant brought the rifle to his shoulder, but before he squeezed the trigger, a rocket streaked from the bird's starboard stub wing. He and his two friends dropped flat to the deck. The missile fell a little short, impacting against the side of the barge instead of its deck, but it carried an incendiary warhead. It exploded in a gushing bloom of red and yellow flame. The concussion slammed painfully into their bodies, and the intense heat washed over them as if they had just opened the door to a blast furnace. The three of them climbed to their feet, retreating from the blaze, eating hungrily at the hull of the barge. The gunship swerved up, inscribed a short but sharp parabolic curve, and dived down again, chain gun hammering. Bullets snapped all around them, sparking from the deck plates, chunking into canvas-covered cargo. Instinctively, the three Outlanders scattered. They knew that by separating, the pilot would pause for a couple of seconds while he decided which target to pursue. Kane reached the far side of the barge and hesitated at the rail long enough to cast a glance over his shoulder to see the gunship arrowing directly for him.
Figures.
He vaulted overboard, entering the surprisingly cold water feet first. Helped by the weight of his sin eater, he sank quickly, his ears registering the muffled multiple thumps of bullets striking the water. He opened his eyes, the brine stinging him, but he saw bubble-laced streaks of the slugs punching into the sea around him. Highlighted by the jeweled glitter of sunlight, the patterns looked almost mesmerizing. He swam up close to the sheltering hull of the barge, scraping his shoulders against the barnacles. Kane's contact hissed with a squirt of static.
Kane, you need to move away!
The barge suddenly shuddered brutally, shockwaves traveling through it and into the water around him. He heard the thunderclaps of detonating missiles, and the suffused sunlight acquired a flickering orange hue. The pilot of the Deathbird was apparently taking out his frustration over losing Kane against the barge. Or he simply intended to flash blast Bridget and Grant. Pushing the fear for his friends from the forefront of his mind, Kane stroked toward the shadow of another derelict, a half-submerged sailboat. He swam under the surface, pushing jetsam and debris aside. When he reached the overhang of the boat's prow, he slowly rose, raking his hair out of his eyes. Flame washed the deck of the barge. Acrid smoke boiling up from it darkened the sky.
Grant! Baptiste! Are you all right? Grant! Baptiste! Respond!
Cold fingers of dread knotted in his chest. Treading water, he inched out from the sheltering shadow cast by the prow of the boat, scanning the sky for the Deathbird. He couldn't hear the sound of its vanes or the engines over the fierce crackle of the fire aboard the barge. Staying close to the hulls of the wrecks, Kane swam out into the ship graveyard, working his way warily, cursing the oppressive heat and the brilliant sunlight. He heard the strong thrum of the engines and the chop of whirling blades as the Deathbird hovered over a nearby derelict. It fired a strafing burst, then moved on. He could only hope the pilot was hunting for Bridget and Grant and not just him. If they were being sought, it meant they still lived. Bridget raced across the deck of the barge, the rattling of the chain gun filling her ears. She reached the stern and hazarded a swift look behind her. She saw Kane leaping overboard and realized he had the right idea since the chopper had evidently chosen to pursue only one of them, him. She crouched at the side, not able to see Grant because of the canvas-covered crates. She activated her contact.
Kane, you need to move away!
The ripping whoosh of a missile lancing from the Deathbird's launch tube reminded her she had more immediate concerns and galvanized her into motion. She dived over the side, plunging into the sea. Dragged down by the weight of Grant's Sin Eater, her copperhead, and a handgun at her belt. She felt and heard the missile barrage impact against the barge. She stroked deep, opening her eyes despite the salty sting. The water was clear, the sun shone bright, and her visibility was unimpaired. The Sin Eater made swimming difficult, so she had no choice but to let it go. She watched it sink toward the bottom, a stream of bubbles rising in its wake. The shadow of the hovering gunship momentarily blotted out the sunlight. She stroked steadily toward a collection of derelicts, squeezing between those positioned closely together. A couple rubbed hull to hull, and she swam under those. Only when her lungs began to ache intolerably did Bridget decide to surface. She came up slowly near a cluster of flotsam and pushed her hair away from her face. She tried reaching Kane and Grant on the contacts.
Kane, please respond! Grant, please respond!
She wondered briefly if immersion in seawater had caused the contacts to malfunction. Moving to the clot of debris, she climbed atop a floating timber, carefully stood, then sprang from that to a capsized boat and over more solidly packed jetsam. Although Bridget had spent most of her life as an academic involved in scholarly pursuits, she possessed a natural inborn agility and sure-footedness. She managed to keep her balance on logs that bobbed and rolled, selecting with keen precision which piece of driftage appeared to be the most likely to support her weight. As she gained a heavy timber, the thrumming of the Deathbird's engines and the whickering of its vanes suddenly increased in volume. Bridget instantly dropped into the water, taking a breath and ducking under the timber. She dived deep, noting the comet streaks of bubbles marking the trail of 50-caliber bullets plowing beneath the surface. Bridget forcefully stroked for the hulk of a nearby sloop. When she reached the sloop, she surfaced, pressing against the waterlogged hull timbers. She looked around, but did not see the Deathbird hovering over the graveyard of seagoing vessels. It was a marvel that even a vestige of the marina remained, so it must have been a huge, sprawling place 2 centuries before. After waiting nearly a minute without hearing or seeing the Deathbird, Bridget pulled herself out of the water and threw a jagged rent in the side of the sloop. She found herself standing thigh-deep inside a stateroom, its floor tilted at a 30-degree angle. She took the opportunity to catch her breath, drinking in great lungfuls of oxygen. Suddenly, the whine of the gunship's engine penetrated the interior of her shelter like the buzz of a gigantic, furious insect. The shadow it cast floated right beside the schooner. She stepped back from the opening in the hull, but obviously the pilot knew she was inside. She doubted he would waste time raking the ship with machine gun fire, not when an incendiary missile would turn her bolt hole into a crematorium. Bridget sloshed across the cabin to the door, but one glance showed her rust-eaten hinges and a warped frame. It would probably take a missile to open it. She turned to the decaying bulkhead, holding her copperhead at hip level. Pressing down the trigger, she stitched a human-sized oval into the wall. Casting a glance over her shoulder, she saw the light peeping in from the outside, blotted out by a black shape. Without decreasing her finger pressure on the trigger, she whipped the flame-blooming bore of her subgun toward it, hearing the clang and whine of ricochets. Ceasing fire, Bridget tucked her chin against her shoulder and sprang forward, hurling her entire weight against the bulkhead. The bullet perforations broke away, and the section burst outward in a scattering of waterlogged fragments. Before she struck the water, the Deathbird launched another incendiary missile. The warhead erupted with a flash of orange flame and black smoke in the cabin she had just occupied. The concussion slapped her sideways and flipped her into midair like a poker chip. She smashed into the water on her back, forcing the air from her lungs. Her mouth reflexively opened as she gagged for breath, and water gushed down her throat, into her nose, and trickled through her sinus passages. Dazed, she felt the hellish heat of the incendiary compounds wash over her, and she clawed at the water to get away from it. A distant part of her realized that diving was a mistake, since she hadn't taken a breath. She tried to stroke back to the surface. She had no idea in which direction it lay. There seemed to be nothing but blackness all around her, a chill, engulfing blackness. Over 2 years before, she had nearly drowned in the Irish Sea, and since that day, she had developed a morbid fear, almost a phobia, of dying by water. Bridget kicked furiously, praying she wasn't stroking for the bottom of the graveyard of ships. Grant and Kane shared almost as many differences as similarities. However, both men possessed one particular personality trait so strongly they were almost twins. They hated being chased. His heart pumping hard, Grant sprinted across the deck of the barge. He felt a surge of angry revulsion at being forced into the role of prey yet again. His many years as a magistrate had accustomed him to being the hunter, not the hunted, even if a fellow mag was hunting him. As he bounded toward the aft section of the boat, Grant heard the vanes whipping the air and the engine sounds growing louder with every passing instant. He risked a backward glance. The helicopter was barely 30 feet behind him, perhaps only 15 feet above the deck. Flickering spear points of yellow flame danced briefly just beneath the chopper's prow. There came a rattling roar, and 50-caliber bullets knocked up great gouts of planking behind him. Grant sprinted in a left-to-right zigzag. A rocket exploded against the deck, and the concussive force lifted him like a child's toy and sent him cartwheeling over the side. He plunged headlong into the water, struggling to maintain his grip on the big Barrett. Its 35-pound weight dragged at his arms, threatening to pull him under like a stone. He kicked furiously, wincing at the complaints from the areas of his body where Baron Beausoleil had tortured him with an infrasound wand only a few weeks before. Blinking the stinging brine from his eyes, he watched as the black helicopter whirled, ascended, and zoomed away. Turning onto his back, rifle held crossways across his chest, Grant kicked away from the blazing barge, praying the dancing wall of fire and the corkscrewing clouds of smoke would mask his threshing movements from the Deathbird's pilot. As he kicked furiously, he saw the gunship swoop down some yards away. A storm of 50-caliber slugs punched a cross-stitch pattern in the hull of a half-sunken derelict. Grant wondered whom he was shooting at, Bridget or Kane. Then the bird moved on. He reached a fishing trawler. Despite how clumsy it looked compared to some of the more modern craft, it floated surprisingly high in the water, supported by the wood of its hull. Pieces had fallen out of it, and the wheelhouse lacked a roof. It was a miracle the ship floated at all. Grant boarded the craft, burdened by sodden clothes, water-filled boots, and the rifle. Boots squishing loudly, water streaming from his clothes, Grant crossed the canted deck to the wheelhouse and crouched in the shadow it cast. Within seconds, he heard the ominous thump of the gunship's rotor blades. Grant assumed the pilot was still searching for targets, and his hands tightened around the Barrett at the notion he might be the last one the bird sought. Carefully, he inched his way to the corner of the wheelhouse and peered around. He glimpsed the aircraft bank leisurely to starboard, lining up a shot. Four rockets streaked from the stub wings. Grant was unprepared for the sudden onslaught. Fiery yellow-red eruptions and mushrooming billows of smoke rose among the collection of derelicts. The thunder of the detonations compressed his eardrums. For a moment, the air itself seemed to ignite as columns of flame flashed among the hulls. The streams of slugs from the minigun pounded through rotten, water-soaked wood at 1,000 rounds per minute. It became obvious to Grant that the Deathbird pilot no longer wanted to bring them back alive. Grant checked the action of the Barrett, but he knew the only sure way to ascertain if the rifle had been damaged by its immersion in seawater was to fire off a round. He hazarded a quick glance to fix the position of the black chopper. Then he rolled from cover, crab-walking, until he reached the point he wanted. The Deathbird hovered only 25 yards away and only about 40 feet up. The cockpit presented only a one-quarter view to Grant, so a clean shot at the pilot wasn't an option. He centered the Barrett's sights on the tail boom assembly and fired. The recoil slammed him backward on the slick, slanted surface of the trawler's deck. He saw slivers of metal fly away from an exhaust cowling, and the helicopter sideslipped violently. The chopper veered to starboard, the overstressed engine whining. It rotated in the air until the foreport faced Grant. He put the scope's crosshairs over the outline of the pilot.
Thanks, asshole.
His belly turning a cold flip-flop, Grant realized a fresh round had not been cycled automatically from the box magazine. He also knew the Deathbird's pilot wouldn't permit him the time to manually recycle the weapon. The black chopper arrowed toward him, but Grant stood his ground, too angry to run or to jump overboard. The lines of impact from the Deathbird's minigun scampered across the surface of the sea, intersected with the hull of the trawler, and flung wood chips and splinters in all directions. The chain gun suddenly stopped its jackhammer rhythm. The pilot realized he had fired it dry at the same time Grant did. His course and trajectory were too steep, his altitude too low to safely launch a rocket. He would fly right into the explosion. The gunship began a whining, straining vertical ascent, and Grant, moving on impulse, cupped the butt of the Barrett rifle in his right hand and lunged forward right beneath the chopper. He heaved the weapon straight up into the main rotor blades. Fragments of the rifle and the vanes flew off in all directions, slicing through the mast of a half-sunken schooner and skimming across the surface of the sea like a stone cast into a pond. The Deathbird's engine faltered, keened and stuttered as the pilot frantically struggled to bring the craft back under control. When the rotor blades slowed their spin, Grant glimpsed ugly notches marring the edges. The Deathbird inscribed a wobbling course over the trawler. Grant sprinted across the deck. A hoist and boom arm assembly still stood intact. He bounded toward it and leapt, his feet gaining uncertain purchase on the tilting, slick surface of the assembly. He ran up it as if it were a ramp and, using the topmost block as a springboard, launched himself from it, arms extended. His hands slapped against and closed around the helicopter's portside landing gear. With a whiplash motion of his body, he swung up onto the metal rail, right arm and leg hooking around the struts. He unsealed the latch and popped it open. The pilot turned in his seat, uttered a cry of fright, and struggled with the controls. He was a relatively young man. He was not wearing his helmet or even his sin eater. The aircraft lurched, then righted itself. The magistrate drove a fist in a straight-arm punch at Grant. Grant reached across the magistrate for the control stick.
Take us down!
Fuck you!
Snarling in exertion and fury, the magistrate unlatched his safety harness and half slid out of his seat, punishing Grant with a flurry of punches and kicks. His eyes were wild with rage and a mounting panic. Grant had seen men react like this before, men who, when faced with the possibility of their own deaths, turned into mindless, snarling animals. Legs hooked around the strut of the landing skid, Grant defended himself instinctively, and the pilot's feet and fists hit only his arms, elbows, and shoulders. One penetrated his guard, and Grant felt a side-handed blow that split the corner of his lower lip. At the sudden blaze of pain, the taste of blood, Grant lunged into the cockpit and grabbed the magistrate around the throat in a stranglehold. The pilot clawed at his hand, trying to pry Grant's fingers from his windpipe and larynx. With every iota of his upper body strength, Grant slammed the man's head against the side ob port. A small network of cracks spread from the impact point, but the magistrate didn't lose consciousness. He threw himself from side to side, trying to break Grant's death grip on his throat. His elbow struck the control stick, and the helicopter yawed and went into a prolonged, stomach-turning spin. Grant was forced to release the pilot and grasp the edges of the hatch. Beneath him, he glimpsed a stretch of blue water, smoke, and derelict boats, all wheeling crazily. The aircraft's spiraling descent slowed and finally ceased, a bare 20 feet above the deck of the fishing trawler. The pilot had regained control, and the chopper rose again, straight up, as if drawn by a celestial magnet. Grant clawed himself back into the cockpit, bracing his feet against the landing skid.
I said, take us down!
I said, fuck you! Oh!
Grant lost his balance, his feet slipping from the skid. He teetered on it, trying to tip himself forward toward the cockpit. His groping hand found the control stick, and he shoved it forward. The chopper's nose pitched down at a sharp angle as the horizontal stabilizers were locked out. The death bird plummeted toward the trawler. Grant kicked himself away from the skid, launching himself into empty air. The blue surface of the Cific sped up toward him. He didn't have time to slip into a vertical position, and so enter the water in a dive, so he curled himself into a tight ball. The water smashed at him. The brine stung his cut lip like liquid hellfire, and he fought to stay beneath the surface. He opened his eyes and looked up, seeing the outline of the fishing trawler only a few yards away. Within a second, a hell-hued blossom of fire flared as the death bird crashed into the ship's deck. Tongues of flame lapped out and leaped in all directions. When the noisiest and most pyrotechnic aspects of the death bird's crash tapered away, Grant slowly rose to the surface and surveyed his surroundings. The burning, ebony hulk of the gunship lay canted at a grotesque angle on the trawler's deck. Its stub wings had been blown off by the missile detonations, and with the rotor blades missing and the tail assembly bent almost double, the chopper's fuselage looked like a giant maimed grasshopper. Scarlet sheets of flame jumped high all around the derelicts, and a pall of smoke blurred the wrecks. Treading water, Grant activated his contact, but received no signal.
Dane! Bridget!
After a moment, his ears caught a faint reply, but because of the crackle of flames, he wasn't sure who had responded.
Here.
He swam slowly in the direction he thought the voice had come from.
Bridget! Kane!
Here! Over here!
Breaststroking around a clot of flotsam, Grant saw Kane and Bridget Baptiste hanging onto a long timber. She was retching, dry heaving. Her eyes were closed, her mouth sagging open. Her shoulders shuddered, and she didn't seem to be aware of much of anything.
I saw her go down. I think an explosion dazed her, but I got to her in time. She probably swallowed only a gallon of the Cific.
Bridget gasped and vomited a cupful of water. She struggled to take a deep breath and opened her eyes. She stared around unfocusedly with reddened, glassy eyes.
Status?
We're safe for the moment. Grant clipped the bird's wings.
Grant, I had to jettison your sin eater. Sorry.
Plenty more of them back in Cerberus.
Kane glanced into the sky at the smoke staining the limitless canopy of azure. It seemed strange that it was barely mid-morning after all that had happened since daybreak.
Speaking of home, why don't we start back? We've got a jump on the day, at least.
You feel strong enough to get back to dry land?
Yeah, but I've had about all I can stand of water sports for the day.
Bridget clung to the timber while Grant and Kane pushed it ahead of them, propelling it with their kicking legs, maneuvering through the graveyard of ships. Kane's tongue felt like a strip of cured leather. The soft tissues of his throat were as abraded as if he'd been gargling with sand, and his eyes stung. He knew if they couldn't find a source of fresh water to bathe in, they would be scratching at their salt-caked bodies all the way back to Montana.
This mission was a complete waste of time. Instead of adding to our store of ordnance, we lost some.
Yeah, but we cost Baron Snakefish some, too. In materiel and manpower.
I don't think we or the Baron lost as much as Breeze Castiglione. We ought to take a little consolation in that.
Oh, I'm consoled. This is how I look when I'm consoled.
You look like shit.
Now you're getting it.
Soon, the shoreline became visible.
There are a lot worse things we could be doing, you know.
Yeah, but they'll have to wait until I change into some dry underwear.
By the time Domi trotted up the crumbling blacktop, the sun had begun to set. Long shadows lanced from the peak of the mountain towering high above her. The blazing glory of fusing sunset colors filled the sky. They should have been a beautiful sight, but the girl scarcely noticed them. Instead, she glanced worriedly at the Kron strapped to her wrist and quickened her pace. The full knapsack hanging from her belt bumped against her left hip. The Detonix Combat Master 45 filled a holster on her right hip, but her step was swift and sure. Born a half-feral child of the Outland, Domi had never fallen into the habit of paying much attention to the passage of time. Her attitude toward it was simple and pragmatic. When the sky was light, it was time to wake and hunt. When it grew dark, she slept. But as dusk began to collect around the plateau, she was thinking of activities other than sleep. At such a high altitude, despite the spring growth far below in the flatlands, the frosty night winds were not kind to creatures of warm blood. A chill breeze suddenly gusted down from the peaks, and Domi shivered. She wasn't dressed for low temperatures. Khaki shorts, a white tank top, and nothing else. She almost never wore shoes, since her feet were calloused on the soles. An albino, Domi was barely 5 feet tall and weighed all of 100 pounds. Her unruly bone-white hair was cropped short, and her bright red eyes, shining like polished rubies on either side of her thin-bridged nose, lent her a ghostly aspect. Despite the scars marring the pearly perfection of her white skin, particularly the one shaped like a starburst on her right shoulder, Domi was beautiful. Her body was a liquid, symmetrical flow of curving lines, with small, pert breasts rising to sharp nipples, and a flat, hard-muscled stomach extending down to her flared hips. The old blacktop she walked was steep and treacherous. It stretched up from the foothills and plunged deeply through the Bitterroot Range before turning into a twisting, rugged hellway. It skirted dizzying abysses on one side and slid along foreboding, overhanging crags on the other. On her left, beyond the tree line, rocky ramparts plunged straight down to a tributary of the Clark Fork River nearly 1,000 feet below. The few people who lived in the region held the Bitterroot Mountain Range, colloquially known as the Darks, in superstitious regard. Due to their mysteriously shadowed forests and deep, dangerous ravines, a sinister body of myths had grown up around the range. Enduring folklore about evil spirits lurking in the mountain passes to devour body and soul kept the curious and greedy from exploring too far. There were other reasons for the sinister body of myths ascribed to the Darks. The least of them, legends about ferocious blood-freezing storms and flesh-eating fogs. Both had their basis in reality, but over the past century they had been blown out of all rational proportion. Neither Domi nor anyone else who lived in Cerberus cared to tear away the veil of frightful fable from the shrouded peaks. All the scare tales were a form of protective coloration that no amount of Jack, not even Vil Scrip, could buy. Domi stumbled on a loose piece of asphalt and stubbed a toe.
Ow, shit!
The road wound and twisted, as if its builders had followed the trail made by a giant broken-backed snake, thrashing and whipping in its death throes. She turned another bend, then topped a rise. The road widened as it entered a broad plateau. A grim gray peak of granite shouldered the sky on the far side of the plateau. At its base gaped open the vanadium alloy security door that led into the heart of the Cerberus Redoubt. The mountain peak concealing the Cerberus Redoubt was an organized masterpiece of impenetrability and inaccessibility. 2 centuries before, trained labor and the most advanced technology available had worked hand in glove to ensure that no one might even suspect it existed. For a handful of years, from the end of one millennium to the beginning of another, it had housed the primary subdivision of the Totality Concept's over Project Whisper, Project Cerberus. The Totality Concept was the umbrella designation for American military super-secret researches into many different arcane and eldritch sciences. The 3-level, 30-acre Cerberus facility had come through the new cost more than intact. It and most of the other Totality Concept-related redoubts had been built according to specifications for maximum impenetrability, short of a direct hit. With its vanadium alloy radiation shielding still in good condition and powered by fission nuclear reactors, Cerberus could survive for at least another 500 years. The multi-ton vanadium security door was already folded aside accordion fashion as Domi crossed the tarmac. As she approached, Lakesh stepped out of it. Mohandas Lakesh Singh was a well-built man of medium height, with thick, glossy black hair, an unlined dark olive complexion, and a long aquiline nose. He looked no older than 45, despite a few strands of gray streaking through his temples. In reality, he was just a year or so shy of celebrating his 250th birthday. As a youthful genius, Lakesh had been drafted into the web of conspiracy that the overseers of the Totality Concept had spun during the last couple of decades of the 20th century. As a physicist and cyberneticist, he worked for Project Cerberus, which dealt with matter transfer.
I was getting a little worried. You're overdue by about an hour.
I can take care of myself.
With Grant, Bridget, and Kane away on a mission, there are very few here who are capable of finding you if you become lost.
You could find me easy enough if you had the right kind of motivation.
And what might that be, young lady?
Domi increased her pace and threw herself into his welcoming arms. He kissed her passionately, and she reciprocated, her tongue touching his. Reluctantly, Lakesh broke the embrace.
How went the herb hunt?
Domi unslung the knapsack and patted it.
Not too badly. I found a lot of useful things.
I'm not sure how useful Dr. DeFore will find them.
It's Quavel's choice.
The sack bulged with roots, plants, and herbs Domi had spent most of the day gathering in the woods. Although the infirmary of the redoubt carried a wide assortment of drugs and pharmaceuticals, the Outlander girl placed more faith in natural healing agents, particularly when prenatal care was involved. Quavel's pregnancy had already manifested a few unusual qualities, so Domi figured any and all treatments should be made available to her, not just those approved and dispensed by Reba DeFore. Domi had grown up in a primitive settlement on the banks of the Snake River in Hell's Canyon, Idaho. More than once, despite her young age, she had assisted in the birth of children.
As Quavel's physician, Dr. DeFore might feel she should have some input.
Let's find out.
Lakesh followed her into the redoubt, smiling at her as they passed the illustration of Cerberus on the wall above the door control. Although the official designations of all Totality Concept-related redoubts were based on the phonetic alphabet, almost no one who had ever been stationed in the facility referred to it by its official code name of Bravo. The mixture of civilian scientists and military personnel simply called it Cerberus. One of the enlisted men with artistic aspirations went so far as to illustrate the wall next to the entrance with an image of the 3-headed hound that had guarded the gateway to Hades. Rather than attempt even a vaguely realistic representation, he used indelible paints to create a slavering black hellhound with a trio of snarling heads sprouting out of an exaggeratedly muscled neck. The neck was bound by a spiked collar, and the 3 jaws gaped wide open, blood and fire gushing between great fangs. In case anyone didn't grasp the meaning, he emblazoned beneath the image the single word Cerberus, wrought in overdone, ornate Gothic script. Domi kissed her forefinger and touched it to the portrait. She had drifted into the habit of giving the illustration, the totem of the redoubt, little greeting and farewell kisses when she passed by. Lakesh found the ritual silly but endearing. He had found very little about the past 50 years of his life endearing. After the nuke cost, Lakesh had volunteered to be placed in cryogenic stasis in the anthill, the largest of the totality concept-linked installations. 5 decades before, he had been revived and drafted to serve the program of unification, the agenda to create the 9 barons, the 9 god-kings to rule the Earth. It was only after his resurrection that he had realized the horrific magnitude of the plan to conquer humanity. Lakesh had tried many times since his resurrection to arrest the tide of extinction engulfing the human race. First had been his attempts to manipulate the human genetic samples in storage, preserved in vitro since before the nuke cost, to provide the hybridization program with a supply of the best DNA. He had hoped to create an underground resistance movement of superior human beings to oppose the Barons and their hidden masters, the Archon Directorate. A revolutionary force needed a headquarters, and the Cerberus Redoubt seemed the most serviceable. When Lakesh had reactivated the installation some 30 years before, the repairs he made had been minor, primarily cosmetic in nature. Over a period of time, he had added an elaborate system of heat-sensing warning devices, night-vision video cameras, and motion-trigger alarms to the plateau surrounding it. He had been forced to work in secret and completely secluded, so the upgrades had taken several years to complete. The redoubt contained a frightfully well-equipped armory and 2 dozen self-contained apartments, a cafeteria, a decontamination center, an infirmary, a swimming pool, and even detention cells on the bottom level. The facility also had a limestone filtration system that continually recycled the complex's water supply. In a cleft on the peak, mostly hidden by the granite walls and camouflage netting, was an array of dish antennae, a transmitting tower, and even a slowly revolving radar emitter. Domi padded barefoot down the main corridor, a 20-foot-wide passageway made of softly gleaming vanadium alloy and shaped like an arched square. Great curving ribs of metal and massive girders supported the high rock roof. Lakesh walked beside her, noting the curious looks she received from some of the people they passed, but the glances were essentially respectful and even admiring from the men. Although the redoubt had been constructed to provide a comfortable home for well over 100 people, it had pretty much been deserted for nearly 2 centuries. When Domi, Grant, Kane, and Bridget had arrived at the installation 2 years before, there had been only 12 permanent residents. Like them, all of the personnel were exiles from the Vills, but unlike them, the others had been brought here by Lakesh because of their training and abilities. The redoubt had suffered a number of casualties over the past couple of years, and for a long time the Cerberus personnel were outnumbered by shadowed corridors, empty rooms, and sepulchral silences. Over the past month and a half, the corridors had bustled with life, the empty rooms filled, and the silences replaced by conversation and laughter. The immigrants from the Menetius moon base had been arriving on a fairly regular basis ever since the destination lock code to the Luna Gateway unit had been discovered. Whether the new arrivals intended to remain in the installation or to try to make separate lives for themselves in the Outlands was still an open question. In any event, as more women arrived from the moon colony, the redoubt's permanent male population was for the first time in the minority. Bry, Banks, Farrell, Auerbach, and even the misanthropic Wegman acted either like shy schoolboys or mags in a gaudy house after a long patrol. Lakesh followed Domi into the infirmary and saw that both Reba Dufour and Quavel were present in the examination room, Quavel lying on her back on one of the beds. When Lakesh realized a pelvic examination was in progress, he murmured a hasty excuse and an apology and performed a quick about-face. Dufour was standing at the foot of the bed between Quavel's outstretched legs.
I thought we were all scientists here.
I'm an old-fashioned man first, and a scientist second. I'll be in my quarters.
Lakesh stepped out into the corridor.
Don't forget our dinner plans.
Dufour eyed the knapsack and moved away from the bed.
What have you got there?
Rhubarb root, golden thread, peony root, ginger, lime flower, yarrow, dandelion leaves.
Do you know the materia medica of all those?
The what?
The pharmacology.
The what?
Do you know the uses all those herbs could be put to?
Of course I do. How about you?
Reba Dufour's smile widened at the hint of a challenge in Domi's voice.
Actually, my knowledge might surprise you. The benefits of herbal medicine were just being rediscovered before Skydark. I found a few surviving texts and read up on them.
The potentials for therapeutic agents derived from plants are immense.
I personally investigated a few.
But not for yourself, I bet.
No, for the Barons, for their use during their annual medical treatments.
Quivel was a hybrid, a blending of human and so-called Archon genetic material. She was small, smaller even than Domi, under 5 feet in height. She looked almost as young, despite her claim of being 67 years old. Her huge, upslanting eyes of a clear crystal blue dominated a face that a poetically minded man might have tried to describe as elfin, with its high, angular cheekbones. Her lips were small, but like those of most hybrids, they curved naturally upward so that she always seemed to be on the point of smiling, even when her face was in repose. White blonde hair, the texture of silk threads, fell from her domed skull and curled inward at her slender shoulders. Although her beauty had the fascination of being an inhuman loveliness, she was still close enough to humanity's feminine ideal to have aroused a man sufficiently to make love to and impregnate her. A sleeveless white gown swallowed her petite form. It only accentuated the distended condition of her belly and the slenderness of her limbs.
Did you find any?
Not in the kind of quantities wherein a medicine could be distilled.
Well, there's only one of you. I think what I have here will be enough.
Hopefully. If for some reason my physical condition declines, I can be treated with naturally occurring plant remedies. I would prefer them to drugs.
Glad to hear it, since drugs could have some bad effects on you and your baby, seeing as you aren't really, like us.
Quivel didn't appear to be offended.
Very true. My presence here has been the cause for a number of different adaptations and adjustments on everyone's part.
So far, nothing has arisen that good old human ingenuity couldn't deal with. We took care of your nutritional requirements pretty quickly.
As a hybrid, Quivel required food that was easily digestible for her simplified intestinal tract. Although Lakesh had spent a lot of time and trouble to make sure the food lockers and meat freezers of the redoubt were exceptionally well-stocked, there was very little in the way of single-cell protein microorganisms the hybrids normally ingested. Oatmeal and ice cream were improvisations until a way to manufacture the microorganisms could be perfected. Defoe utilized a synthesization process using equipment recently taken from the moon base. The process had so far proved successful.
Well, if you need any help grinding up the herbs, let me know. I've got to get ready for dinner.
Are you dressing for dinner or undressing?
Domi threw her an impish over-the-shoulder grin.
That depends on whether Lakesh wants dessert first or last.
Domi headed for the door.
I envy her joie de vivre.
She's young. It won't last.
How can you be so sure?
Defoe gazed at her steadily for a long moment.
Because one of the contributing factors to her joy of life is rapidly losing his. But it's not my place to let her know. That should be Lakesh's responsibility.
Will he accept it?
Defoe shook her head and moved back to the foot of the bed.
He's the only one who can. It's his life, or what might be left of it. Now, let's finish up your examination.
Domi rolled her hips against Lakesh, her knees clasping him tight. She pressed her palms against his chest, raising herself for another deep downward thrust. Lakesh looked up at her, entranced by the lust showing on her beautiful, hollow-cheeked face. Giving himself over to his own lust, Lakesh stroked upward, clutching her narrow waist. Domi whimpered with each of his long, deep lunges. The sound of her passion, her pleasure, nearly drove him out of his mind as his need for his own release hammered at his skull. Lakesh tried to pace himself, but he started driving harder. When he felt Domi trembling violently, he let his body take over from his mind. He sped up the tempo of his thrusts until he was pounding into her furiously, and Domi cried out sharply with each one. A wail of ecstasy escaped Domi's lips as she ground out her final throes of orgasm against him, and Lakesh allowed his own climax to begin. She shivered, her skin silvery pale in the dim light of his quarters.
Needed that.
She draped herself over him. Lakesh felt her petite body pressed against him like a comfortable blanket. He wrapped his arms around her. After the final spasms finished playing through their bodies, she pushed herself up and looked down into his eyes. He was almost too winded to speak in the aftermath of finally ending his doctor-ordered period of celibacy. She playfully kissed the tip of his nose, then lay beside him, the small nipples of her breasts pressing into his ribs.
I figured a man your age might already be snoring. Thought I'd better do something to wake you up.
You make it difficult to sleep, regardless of my age.
Domi's fingertips lightly traced the faint blue bruise on his chest.
No pain? Not even here?
No, darlingest one. I feel completely healed. Thank you for being so considerate of my rather dissipated physical condition following my encounter with Sam.
He tried to kill you.
Lakesh started to refute her statement, but thought better of it, not wanting to engage the girl in an argument. The fact was, Lakesh knew full well that Sam, the self-professed imperator, had not attempted to murder him during their brief standoff in India. He still remembered with startling clarity what Sam had said to him as he writhed in pain across the corridor floor of the Scorpia Prime's fortress.
I will concede my defeat on this occasion, Mohandas, but it's only a small move in a far larger game. But I'm the game master, and it's up to me whether I'll keep you alive to contend against me another day or kill you at a whim. I have plenty of time to make up my mind.
Months before, upon their initial meeting, Sam had restored Lakesh's physical condition to that of a man in his mid-40s by what seemed to be a miraculous laying on of hands. Sam claimed he had increased Lakesh's production of two antioxidant enzymes, catalase and superoxide dismutase, and boosted his alkaglycerol level to the point where the aging process was, for all intents and purposes, reversed. Only recently had Lakesh learned the precise methodology. When Sam had touched Lakesh, he had injected nanomachines into his body. The nanites were programmed to recognize and to destroy the dangerous replicators, whether they were bacteria, cancer cells, or viruses. Sam's nanites performed selective destruction on the genes of DNA cells, removing the part that caused aging. Faced with a damaged protein, a cell repair machine first had to identify it by examining short amino acid sequences and then look up its correct structure in a database. The machine compared the protein to the blueprint, one amino acid at a time. The nanites stimulated the metabolism by resetting cellular control mechanisms.
Hope we don't have to deal with Sam again. Or that bitch of a mother of his.
Lakesh couldn't help but smile, recalling that Sam's bitch of a mother was well over 200 years old, too, and was as dependent on Sam for her restored youth and vitality as he was.
I doubt we'll contend with either one of them any time in the near future. We knocked the pins out from under Sam's plan to dominate the Asian subcontinent. He'll be reassessing his resources for some time to come.
He still has a toehold in Australia. And what happens if he learns he's really Colonel Thrush?
Sam's true identity is still a matter of speculation.
However, Lakesh knew that to be false. Testimony had indicated that Sam's mind was actually a receptacle for the mind of the loathsome Colonel C.W. Thrush. However, even if Sam served as the living storage vessel for the Thrush program, apparently he had yet to fully download all the algorithmic data and realize his true identity. Quivel had been the one to theorize that the complete Thrush identity ID was suspended in a kind of a memory buffer, with the Thrush identity compressed and not fully downloaded. Domi murmured wordlessly, either in agreement or ennui. Lakesh held her in his arms and wondered if she was dozing. Her eyes were closed, the long, sweeping lashes reminding him of pine needles dusted with snow. He hoped she slept, since he wanted a little time to concoct and rehearse an opening line for the information he needed to impart to her. The results of a recent medical examination had shown that the nanites in his body were now inert. They no longer worked to maintain his metabolism at its restored levels. If Sam had exerted control over them, he had either relinquished it of his own accord as a way to punish him, or the influence had been broken for another reason. Regardless of the reasons, DeFore's prognosis was that he would begin to age, but at an accelerated rate. He'd had no choice but to agree with her gloomy diagnosis. The worst-case scenario she had offered had him revert back to his pre-restoration physical condition within a year's time. The absolute best-case situation would be one where he simply began to age normally from the point the nanites stopped working. He knew that was an unrealistic hope at best. Without the help of Sam's nanomachines, his body simply could not maintain its present state. In fact, the possibility existed that his cardiovascular system would not be able to withstand the strain of rapid aging and would shut down. To be fair to Domi, he knew she needed to be apprised of the circumstances, but he had trouble finding both the words and the courage. He wasn't sure how the little albino girl would react to the prospect that their relationship could conceivably end at any moment. Suppressing a sigh, Lakesh decided to wait until he had more concrete data with which to work before addressing the issue. He would let Domi sleep and catch a nap himself. When he felt her hand stealing toward his groin, Lakesh realized Domi had only been feigning sleep.
"Darlingest one, I don't know if I'm ready for..."
"I'll get you ready."
Domi's fingers ran up and down the shaft of his penis. To his surprise and slight consternation, he realized her touch was indeed having its desired effect. The celibate weeks he and Domi had observed after Sam's attack had apparently had no lasting effect on his enhanced sex drive. For that, at least, he was grateful to Sam. Domi's white-haired head moved down his torso, her soft lips planting kisses along the way. Lakesh smiled in delicious anticipation of when she reached her final destination.
"Lakesh, are you there?"
What?
Donald Bry's voice blared out of the transcom speaker on the wall. The surprise of hearing it, coupled with its strident urgency, was like a bucket of water drawn from a polar sea dashed onto Lakesh and Domi. They both sat up straight in bed.
"Lakesh!"
"What is it?"
It required a great deal of restraint to prevent him from adding the epithet, asshole, onto the end of his question.
"The Matrans sensor lock is registering an anomalous signature from the Luna Gateway Unit."
"Anomalous how?"
"The molecular imaging scanners made a verification lock onto the incoming matter stream. But during the reference signal trace, we got some energy readings that the sensors don't recognize."
Domi snorted, impatient with what sounded like technobabble. Lakesh glanced over at her. She was regarding him petulantly.
"Mr. Bry, either I'm being uncharacteristically obtuse, or you're not expressing the nature of this so-called emergency very clearly."
"I didn't say it was an emergency, but an anomaly. Every piece of matter, whether organic or inorganic, that has ever been transported to or from our gateway here has a computer record in the database."
"Yes, yes. Our image processor scans for patterns corresponding to those in the record."
As Lakesh rose from the bed in order to move closer to the transcom, he became glad that his transmission was audio only.
"Well, whoever or whatever is gating in here from the moon colony is carrying something with a completely unrecognizable energy signature."
"Who from Cerberus is on Manetius at the moment?"
"Well, Newkirk gated there yesterday, so I suppose it could be him returning along with a couple of others. But if it is him, he's got something that's never been materialized or dematerialized in this particular unit."
"Something? By that, do you mean it's inorganic?"
"Yes, of course. I wouldn't bring it to your attention otherwise."
Lakesh, despite the fact he dearly wished to bombard Bry with a torrent of profane invective, realized that the man was only following established security protocols. Although something of an obsessive-compulsive, Bry was not an alarmist by nature.
"I'll be right there. Until then, divert the matter stream into the pattern buffer and hold it there."
"That was the first thing I did. I'm not a moron, you know."
"No, we didn't know."
But Donald Bry had already cut the channel and hadn't heard her. Lakesh reached for his clothes, giving the girl an abashed smile. She gave back only a stony expression.
"This is an unusual situation, so it's best I look into it."
Domi flopped backward onto the bed, the nipples of her small breasts pointing impudently toward the ceiling.
"What about the situation you have here?"
"Hopefully it won't spin out of control until I get back. I shouldn't be long."
"You better not be."
Lakesh gave her nude, supine body a lingering, regretful look and left his quarters.